My name is Rich Stewart. I'm campus minister at Central State University. I have been there for 9 years, 2 years in the parish before that, Wittenberg and Hammer grad. All along the way, I think I had one basic course in economics. I think it was my freshman year in college, which is when I had probably my lowest grade point average, which may say something about my attentiveness in that particular class. So why am I doing this crazy thing this afternoon? I don't know. My wife said that her introduction and her finish to economics training came about age 9, when she realized that you had to have money to go into a store to buy things. She didn't think that was right. That may say an awful lot about where most of us come at the whole issue in the study of economics. My own particular training in this particular narrowed field essentially revolves around 1 week in which a group of clergy, primarily campus clergy, were invited to study the field of economics at a place called New Harmony, Indiana. New Harmony, Indiana was formed by the Harmonists. It was one of those planned communities of people who had both specific social, cultural, manufacturing, and religious values that they wanted to put in effect in a small group community. New Harmony still exists as a kind of a museum piece. But it was kind of interesting to discuss economic values in that particular place that had died. The conference was sponsored by the Indiana Office of Economic Education, which meant that we had economists from Ball State, Purdue, Indiana University, who were able to probably do a better job of enticing me into the field of economics than had my college professors at Wittenberg. And it was an interesting week because there were some unique people there beyond just the base core teaching economist. One of the guests was Dr. Phil Shriver, who's the president of Union Theological Seminary. He was the theological resource of whom we bounced off of both the kind of economic values and the spiritual values that sometimes came into direct conflict. Michael Novak, who wrote some books in the 60s about poverty, and who was a Catholic layman and who now finds himself moving toward a rightist position, but from a Christian perspective of being very conservative about economic policies. One of the other guests was the president of Bethlehem Steel and the president of the Indiana American Federation, AFL-CIO, American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations. And the last guest was probably the least favorite for me. His name was Ernest Lefevre, who at that point in time was still working for the same lobbying and think tank office that he is now residing in Washington. And this was all prior to the election. As a matter of fact, in the middle of the conference, I think it was that Wednesday evening, on television came the last debate between Carter and Reagan. The irony was when we started pressuring the economists to give us a candidate they liked neither one. So in the midst of that, that's been the core of my economic education. And I'd like to know how much you know about economics. How does this country run? Pardon? Unlike any household in this country. You may be right. Any other images as to how this country operates?
On a free market system, basically.
Okay, any other images?
Capitalism.
All of which are probably accurate. None of which are in pure form. This is the first time I've had to use this, so you're going to have to bear with me. If I get my back to you, yell out, you can't see. Several economic writers are people who write about that field, and I think they're absolutely insane. Starting with Keynes and going on up from there, John Kenneth Galbraith included. I think anyone who really deals with this seriously for a living has got to be nuts. Because there's no way you can understand all of it. But several have said that essentially economics began out of the whole issue of a person being able to supply their own needs. That may say something about the kind of nature of this community and the way in which it is founded and they're trying to grow. That when a person was able to supply all their needs, let's say you owned a small farm, you could raise all the food you had, you needed, you had a few sheep, you could spin some wool, you had a couple of milk cows, you were essentially self-contained. There was no need for any kind of economic structure. What happened was that people began to give a little. You would say, at the end of the season, you'd have a harvest festival. And if the harvest was good, the festival would be bigger than normal. And those who might have had a disaster, their farms were down in the gullies, or the spring thaws flooded out their plains. Your profits on the midlands or the highlands would be helped to offset the kind of problems that had other people in trouble. And so the gift-giving of that harvest time became a part of the whole economic system. Beyond that, it revolved into the whole point that some people began to do some specialization. You were particularly good with milk cows. I was particularly good with hogs. Somebody else was a good grain grower. And what we started to do was a barter system, so that my hog over here was worth a year's supply of milk from you. And if I gave you a couple of hogs to butcher over here, you would give me a reasonable supply of grain to supply my cows in the wintertime, or my hogs in the wintertime, and vice versa, the milk. It became a trading system. If you had something I needed and I had something you needed, we could work out a deal. We find that happening even in today's society. Sometimes it's what they call working off the record. I have the skills of an electrician, but I'm not licensed, and you need some electrical work done in your house. Pay me in cash and I'll get it done. Same essential system. Well, as that system began to develop, we became much more specialized. And so we had lots of supply and demand issues. Over here we might have the candlestick maker, the baker, butcher, down here we might have the livery stable, and over here we would have assorted farmers. It became a sophisticated system of barter. The trading cycle sometimes would be very cyclical. And sometimes it would just cross over. But somehow, in the process of doing the economy, of keeping a small knit group of people together, it worked. I think one of the images that I saw on the way out here was traveling through the Amana community, where each one of the communities kind of had its own little separate niche in nature. But they all functioned together as seven different communities. I didn't realize, I always thought, Amana, Iowa was just one town. I didn't realize it was seven separate towns. And the places that we recognize now as the plant, the place where the plants are for the refrigeration and air conditioning and stoves, that sort of stuff, that's only one place. The vast majority of the Amana community still revolves around farming. But they also have their furniture store and their gift stores to trap us tourists to go through. But somehow they have continued to function as a community. And one of the more recent things I've seen in publication is some real desire for them to broaden out so that when visitors come through the area, there are some real live places for them to stay. Because they don't want to keep the architecture the same, the style of the community the same, and they feel that by bringing in more visitors, that will change the nature of the community. And they are still structured on a community government, kind of like the old New England town meeting. Everybody has a vote and a voice. Well, what happens is when you bridge beyond the small community, you have to do some other kinds of things. One of the ways in which we translate our products of value into marketable or usable other kinds of talents is the whole issue of money. And what we try and do is essentially say the same thing about money that we did about the barter system, that money represents the sum accumulation of our time and our talents invested in our labors. So that the money that I get for the sale of a cow should represent the cost of my farm, the cost of my implements, the fair shared cost of my own time in terms of raising that hog, so that the money that is representative of that same hog that I would normally have traded someplace else. But what it does, it gives me access to a wider market. I mean, I just can't live in the hills of Iowa and ship a hog to somebody in New York City because I want what they've got. So that was translated into a form called money, currency. And for the bulk of our country's existence, all of this was backed by a gold standard. So that we understood that not only was the paper money that we have good in terms of the value that we put into it, but it was also guaranteed by the government in a form that was tangible in other kinds of circles outside of this country. Surprisingly enough, that only changed very recently under the Nixon administration, even though the government had the ability to change from the gold standard under Harry Truman. So we went through almost 3.5 administrations before it really kind of did change. But for the most part, that's how it functioned. And that money then became the kind of thing that we trade between the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker for our goods and services. And as our specializations change, the way in which we then barter what we have changes. I mean, in the old days, a preacher like me wouldn't get a whole lot of cash, but I would sure end up with a lot of canned goods, fruits, vegetables, can of milk about once a week to sustain my family. But somehow in the process of that, my goods and services were translated by the people in the parish into a form which they could then respond. Cash was only one part of that. As we become a much more specialized society, that takes on much more definitive ramifications in using cash, currency. So, we start running into some distinct problems because my hogs aren't just used in Holden Valley anymore. They're now taken down the hillside to Lake Chelan, put on a boat and taken down to Chelan Village in Wenatchee and up to Leavenworth. Well, somehow I've got to figure out a value for those hogs. And I've also got to somehow every year figure out how many hogs I want my sows to bear, how many piglets I'm going to put off for market, how many I'm going to keep, and how many I'm going to keep just for myself. I don't want to overproduce. I mean, if I'm stuck with too big a hog herd and I can't get rid of it, then I got a major problem. If I got too small a hog herd, then the folks in Leavenworth might not get theirs, because by the time the cart goes from here to Chelan to Wenatchee, it just may run out before it gets to Leavenworth. So I've got to be very careful about how many hogs I raise. So I kind of, you know, make some projections about how many people bought last year, or how many I bartered for the year before. And so I come up with a demand that there's going to be a need for 50 full-size hogs at the end of the season. That's called what is my predicted demand. Now, as long as I have a demand for 50, and at the end of the season, I can supply 50, everything is easy street. But what happens if I only come up with 48? And the people in Chelan are giving me $40 a hog. And the people in Leavenworth said, well, we still need those two hogs, and you're only going to produce 48 this year. How about we give you 60? That's called inflation. Very simple, I think. I'm still not sure of all my facts, but, you know, hang with me, folks. Essentially, the whole market system is based on supply and demand, the free market system, capitalism. There are a number of names in which it comes down. It doesn't matter whether it's hogs, computers, televisions, radios, automobiles, clothing, shoes, whatever. Manufacturers make a guesstimate as to what the demand will be, and they hope that their projections on demand will also equal their supply. Now, the other problem is, what happens if, you know, the demand is only for 50 hogs, but my sows really go berserk this year and I come up with 60? Well, I either have to absorb some marketing things to get them this further on beyond Leavenworth. I mean, over Stevens Pass is a little tough, folks. And so I'm going to incur some additional expenses. Or I'm just going to have to somehow absorb the fact that I raised 10 more hogs than I need to give. Or the folks in Chelan will make me a deal and say, well, how about we take, instead of 30 hogs, we'll take 32 hogs. But we won't give you $40 for them, we'll give you $35. Well, that's called deflation, recession. I mean, I've produced 10 more hogs, I've eaten 10 more hog-sized meals for so many days. I've had to buy more corn from my corn supplier. Somewhere along the line, I'm not going to make as much as I did in past years because I produced too many. Supply and demand. If they remain equal, then things run pretty smoothly. If they do not remain equal, then things get out of kilter. And that's when we have recession or inflation. Now,
let's talk about the money supply.
If I have time. I think we'll try and get into that whole issue of the Federal Reserve System as best I understand it. I again state, I ain't an expert, folks. Into this whole mix, we thrust something that's really weird. We come up with a man by the name of Henry Ford. I mean, it could be a lot of other names, but that's a good one that folks can recognize. You see, we've operated off the horse and cart scene down to Chelan Lake for years. I mean, steam engines have been around for a long time, but this guy puts together the horseless carriage. I don't have to worry about stuff in my streets anymore. He comes up with a new idea for which I don't know if there's a market. The town I went to school in, Springfield, Ohio, had the distinction of having been considered as a site for General Motors at one point because one of the places in town was a foundry that made piano plates. And the owner of the piano plate company, when approached by Chevrolet and Cadillac to see if he would join them in his consortium because he had played around with automobiles, decided that pianos were going to be here forever and the car was a passing fad. Ah, well. He didn't understand, or at least his projections didn't tell him that something else was happening. So the piano plate company is still there making piano plates, and we don't have a car factory in Springfield. International Harvester is there, but that came much later because of farms, not because of trucks. So Henry Ford comes up with a new idea. It has four wheels and people ride in it, and that's kind of weird, but that's okay. Somehow he creates a product for which he then has to create a market. Called the entrepreneur. And he takes a lot of risk. I mean, you know, he invests everything he owns, his wife owns, his kids own, and anything else he can have other trusted people invest in him. And they all take a calculated risk that somewhere along the line there's going to be a demand for this thing called the car. And he does it in one way. Basic black, very simple, and they all look alike. He figures he's not going to try and confuse the market with too many options. only we could understand that today, maybe. So he produces the car, and a few marginal people say, I'll try it. For the most part, they aren't killed, maimed, or otherwise driven to death. They find that their hearing may be going down because the things are so loud. They scare every other horse in the county, but they like their car. And so in the process, they keep then demanding more cars. Not at great rates, understand that. But gradually the whole process continued that people from the East and the Midwest were able to make roads a little better so the car could sustain itself over the mountains and all across the plains. And eventually it outran the horse. And the horse was consigned to stables and dude ranches. And a few ranches where they didn't have any other options. I can remember just barely growing up in the late 40s, the last one of the milk wagons that was drawn by a horse. And the last couple of vendors who came around who wanted to sharpen your knives on a horse-drawn cart. My kids, for them that just is unthinkable. And as we know now, especially our society, we have become absolutely on board with the car. It is a love affair. So the folks at the Green Plate Piano Plate Company made a miscalculated guess. They were right. Pianos did stay. But not near with the staying power that cars did. Now the problem is, those of us who were on horse ranches raising horses found ourselves in serious trouble. We had to cut back. Either that or we had to alter, instead of raising quarter horses, we started raising thoroughbreds and we moved to Kentucky. And those of you who invested in Henry Ford's dream, like those in Henry Ford's family, you reaped the benefits of his guessing right. Now the question is, how many inventors guessed wrong, and how many people invested in inventors who guessed wrong? But remember, your investment in Henry Ford was not unlike the gift giving at the harvest time. Think about it. Henry Ford had an idea. He hadn't been able to make it as a farmer, but he was going to try and make it as an automobile maker. So you invested the riches of your harvest in his idea. And the catch is, he had a good idea and everybody won. Again, that free market system. Sharing the wealth in some ways, investing the wealth in some ways. And every time a person made an investment, it was a calculated risk. There were no guarantees. Sometimes you got extremely lucky. Okay. Where does that leave us today? Well, we still have a free market system. Laissez-faire to some degree. But we enter with one major change. This is not the capital, but that's what it's supposed to look like. The government does enter the picture. Not only do they supply money, but they also supply some regulations which regulate the industries that make products for all of us. And sometimes we think that those regulations are good regulations. For instance, one of the regulations is that we have a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. That means we don't have to necessarily build cars with 350,000 horsepower. We're not going to get there in 4 seconds. We don't need to get there in 4 seconds because the government says so. Or we have other kinds of regulations. I make pharmaceuticals that are shipped to pharmacists all over the country. But I have to test those pharmaceuticals to make sure that they will not harm the public which uses them. And somewhere in the process, my 55-mile-an-hour speed limit finds itself governing the way in which I produce pharmaceuticals, because I've got to somehow gear into this a slowdown effect, which says I have to test it and test it and retest it to make sure it doesn't do any harm to the public. And my regulatory costs of research and development are built into the cost of that item. And if you need the item, if it's aspirin, and I have aspirin, I try and make sure that my ability to supply equals your demand. In recent years, we have seen some radical changes in that. The automobile industry wanted to supply us with cars that were large and somewhat inefficient. Sorry, that's supposed to be a C. And at the same time, because we have a free market system, there were some other folks who had entered into the picture. Who didn't necessarily always take the money supply that had come out of an industry and reinvest it back into the country. In other words, the workers for these products all bought my hogs, your cows, your grain, and so the cycle continued to operate, that we kept supplying one another. But the workers over here, they were in Japan and Germany. They didn't buy my hogs. They didn't buy your milk. They definitely, unless they were really desperate, didn't buy your grain. And so what happened was, these folks were building small cars that were relatively inefficient. And we also found that we didn't supply all the gas that we needed for our cars. That money also went out of the country to the Middle East. And as we kept spending more and more money to feed these cars, some of us said, maybe we really ought to go for a smaller car. And so now when we're feeding money to the Middle East, we're also feeding money to Japan and Germany. Now the guess is that somehow our exports will always exceed our imports. And for the most part, that has worked for us until recently. Recently, it's changed itself, and we're now a majority importer as opposed to an exporter. So the way in which the currency exchanges hands changes for us. And the currency goes out as opposed to coming back. And I think that's why Mr. Nixon decided to take us off the gold standard. Because for every dollar bill printed, there had to be some gold invested, a dollar's worth of gold invested in this country. And all of us talk about the wealth at Fort Knox. Strange sight to ever go there. It's an awful lot of gold in a large room. Well, the way in which we changed that once we got off the gold standard was to print paper money, which is backed by nothing. God, that's hard to say. I choked on it. But that's really what we're doing. If you have any of the old dollar bills, they say this is backed by gold standard. You have, you know, it's worth a dollar worth of gold. You can get that gold from the government. Read a dollar bill now. There is no guarantee. And so one of the things the federal government can do is print more of them. Since the auto workers were demanding more wages for the same amount of time and essentially the same amount of labor, and somehow the whole process was not working because more money was going out than coming in, we could just print more dollars. But they were not backed by the same kind of standard. The problem is now, part of what's fueled inflation is that we have a whole lot of these out there, which are not backed by anything. Now you asked me about the Federal Reserve Board, and I thought I was going to run out of time before I got there. Been nice. And here I really run into shaky ground, because this one's the hardest one to understand.
Our monetary system, in a sense, is insured by the government. And they sell security notes. And they sell these to banks. Now, if they stay in the Federal Treasury, then they're just sitting there. It's kind of like stored efficiency. But if they sell them to a bank, then the bank pays the government X amount of money, and then the government uses that money out in the marketplace. But at the same time, to get that certificate back when it's sold to the bank, the government has to pay interest. And the way in which the Federal Reserve Board regulates the money supply is by regulating the interest rate on the federal securities. If the interest rate goes down, banks don't want them because they cannot then supply an investment on the capital that their savers have put into their bank to buy the securities. So they unload them. They sell them back to the government. If the interest rates go up, which means that it's nice to have a federal certificate in your bank, you want to buy them. But at the same time, what that means is the interest rates go up and down in terms of the bank and what it gives or does not give to its savers, and their interest rates also go up and down for those who want to borrow from the bank. So if the interest rates are up, they call it tight money. I think that's probably the one term we hear more and more on the radio. The money is tight. Federal Reserve is tight. Interest rates are high. So what does that affect? That affects the rates of interest in terms of buying an automobile. So instead of paying just $6,000 for the automobile, you're also investing another $1,700 in interest. If the interest rates are down, you pay $6,000 for the automobile, and I know that's ridiculous for most automobiles now, but you only pay about $1,200 in interest. And that's the kind of difference that affects the same income we ended up with within a month's time. And the Federal Reserve takes the interest rates and regulates it by the month. For those of you who have, what are they called, certificates? Yeah, the certificates of deposit that fluctuate on a monthly basis, they're tied to the interest rates of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, I haven't seen any hands go up, which means I must have thoroughly confused you. Or the other option is you understood everything I said, both of which scare me. How about we stop there and see if we can get some questions for more clarification. Now, what this has to do with the rest of what I'm going to do during the week really is talking about the way in which we have to look at lifestyle. Because I think it has some relative importance as to what our lifestyle is, both as individuals and as Christians. But to talk about economics without having some kind of basis really gets out into, ya-ya land and go, whoopee. Believe me, the first 2 days of the conference, I was out there. So I kind of know where you are. And you're right, the government does not operate like anybody's household. Yes, ma'am?
Economics of supply and demand then really is not functioning now.
To some degree, that's correct. Because of regulations, things like the deregulation of gasoline costs. We regulated gasoline costs in this country for so long, we didn't know what the real price was. And so the government regulations, which kept the prices of gasoline artificially low, were giving us a false sense of where we were in terms of the world.
But it is working to the extent that Detroit can't sell its cars because it can't produce them at a price that we're willing to pay for.
We got into that yesterday when I talked about some bad management decisions, because I don't think Detroit went into that blind. I think they saw it coming. They made a decision not to meet that need. And that's part of what Henry Ford did was he perceived a need in the future, and then he proceeded to produce something to meet the need. He made a good guess. But you're absolutely right. We're not buying what Detroit is producing because what Detroit is producing does not meet our needs. They're supplying something for which there is no demand.
I think a more important reason for inflation, I kind of disagree a little bit about the supply-demand. I think that the supply-demand concept indicates what you can sell something for. In other words, if you have, like you said, excessive hogs, you're not going to be able to get as much money for them because people won't be willing to pay that. They can get them cheaper. If they're at a premium, people are going to have to pay more. But I don't think that's really inflation. That's the price you have to pay. I think inflation is caused by the excess in the money supply.
If that's true, then we should not have had inflation prior to going off the gold standard, but we had it.
Yeah, but I don't
And that's partly because of the way in which the government involves itself in our lives. And that's not to say that's good, bad, or indifferent, because then we have to make some value judgments about what kind of lifestyle we want to have.
But going off the gold standard is not the only cause of inflation.
It's not the only cause.
We had inflation before going off the gold standard.
That's right.
Not at the same rate.
No.
But what happens is you have transfer payments, and the government says, okay, be it right or wrong, part of our society cannot take care of themselves. And so we're going to take the money from the people who are producing and give it to the people who are not producing.
That's correct.
And so in order to do this, we've got to have more money. And the whole key to the thing is the government controls the printing presses. So they say, okay, we need $100 million for food stamps. It's no problem to print up $100 million. Okay, but that money goes into the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the people who I have something to sell, and I say, okay, well, there's $100 million more dollars out there, so that dollar is worth less. The dollar is worth less. So I've got to have more for my goods. I think that's the real cause of inflation, is the excess of the money supply.
And
that's why the gold standard, when we were on a strict gold standard, there was very little inflation because the government could not print more money. They could only print money to back up the gold that they had, and gold is not easy to get.
That's right.
And that was the only reason the gold standard protected us.
Right.
Didn't accept a dollar because you could trade it for gold.
No.
Because you could use the gold, because individually you didn't really have much use for gold, only your wedding ring and a few things like that, but it really didn't have that value to you. Its value was in restricting the amount of dollars that could be printed.
Right. And the way in which the government does it is not just in social service programs as well.
They need it for defense. And
it goes for defense. Just the cost of operating the government, our representative type. It also goes for social services. And it also goes for, what's the fourth area?
Interest.
Yeah, interest. Because we have borrowed. Generally, the social service area, especially up until the mid-50s, we found that most of those dollars that were spent there were plowed back into the economy. They were not all what you call giveaways. Whether it was the WCC program, the CCC program, it put people to work for projects that benefited the entire community, and those dollars were then plowed back in so that the monies were not lost in terms of the overall community. The cost for government generally pays salaries for people, whether there are representatives and their assistants and their secretaries. But again, it's still plowed back into the whole economic system. The interest, then, is one of the areas that we have to look at, because as it goes up, it means the government pays out more to us, essentially, who save. We are the benefactors of the interest that the government is charged. So if we invest in a certificate of deposit at 17.5%, the bulk of that money is coming out of our own taxes, which kind of sounds kind of strange, but that's where it's coming from. The one area that has the most difficulty in terms of plowing it back into the whole economy is defense. One is, it's a cost-intensive area. We have to pay labor at a rate that is competitive to the open market system and private enterprise. The cost for the equipment does not compare in terms of equal comparison values with equipment that is used in private industry. One is because of the sophisticated nature of the equipment. And two, that equipment also does not provide any benefit for the rest of society. Whether it's in labor, in any of these, they're going to plow the money back in terms of goods and services. They're going to buy food, they're going to commit services. If a corporation has to buy a truck, then that truck is going to go on the free market system. It won't be just a bidding to a company, but it'll go through a dealer, it'll pay a salesman, etc. So it goes through the cycle. Government bidding does not go through that same cycle in quite the same way. Labor, equipment.
I don't think that's the big, that's what you say is true, but I don't think it's the big distinction between the defense spending and the spending for consumer good. The object of production is to produce something that will satisfy a human want. Food, clothing, shelter, recreation, all of our human wants. The only human want that the defense spending provides, if you accept indeed that it provides that, is a sense of security from destruction of the other. You don't eat it, you don't do any of these other things, as you do. And even on your social service, even if you're paying on food stamps, it may not benefit you personally, but the guy down the street, it's benefiting him, and you know that, and you can feel good about that, better about that than you can feel about providing something to kill somebody across the ocean, or to keep him from killing you. That's the real difference, as I see it.
You probably said it a lot clearer than I did. That's essentially where I was trying to go, that this area does not show countering benefits in the rest of society. And the more we spend in here, the less those benefits then are derived by the rest of society.
It's a dead-end investment.
It's a dead-end investment.
You build a tractor, and the guy's going to take out, he's going to grow grain with the tractor, and the grain are going to feed the hogs, and it's a big cycle.
It's a big cycle.
It's kind of like back in the days when we used to raise hogs and kill them and bury them because there were too many hogs.
Mm-hmm. And don't, are you going to lead to what we should do to get ourselves out of this mess, or...
Tomorrow's supply side.
Oh.
Any other questions, though? How many of you, a lot of us have been in college. How many have had an economics course, or two, or three? A few. Am I far off the ballpark?
No, it's simplified, but it needs to be simplified in this context. It leaves out a lot of variables you're complicating deals, but it's basically sound.
Except it doesn't work that way anymore.
Well, that's where we have some different alternatives.
I don't think it's going to work. I mean, I really think that it's so complicated there may be no answer.
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that I expected to hear that I didn't hear was that this was also a typical American system, and that's not true. Economics has no political favor or flavor. When we trade grain to Russia, they then are functioning in a capitalist system, whether they like to admit it or not. When we sell computers to China, our computers happen to be the best in the world. So they are operating on the free market system by buying the best available equipment. How many airlines around the world fly Boeing?
Most of those in the Western world, in the free world.
That's right.
I just read on the way out here, though, when we flew out on Boeing, that the Americans are losing their superiority in air because, again, they misjudged the market again. Mm-hmm. They're building 757s and 767s which are too big, and that the European consortiums are building these Airbuses, which are smaller passengers, two motors instead of three.
And Boeing's trying to recoup with theirs. Was it 737 and 757, well, which is their intermediate?
They recoup for 737. That was a gold mine.
But it's much more complex than free market, I mean, because, okay, we have the free market system for airplanes, say, but it's really not free market because these governments overseas subsidize these companies very heavily. So Boeing has a hard time competing because the French government is giving them 6% loans, and Boeing may have to pay 17% loans. So it's not free market anymore.
It's not free market anymore. It's not pure free market. It's not pure free market in the way Keynes first tried to describe it. It's not pure free market in the way that Adam Smith tried to describe it. Because even when I start talking about Toyota, Datsun, Subaru, every one of the Japanese countries has some financial benefits invested in it by its government. And the question is, you know, at that same point, we keep saying we're competing in a free market system in which our government tries to stay as best hands off. At the same time, we're competing with people whose governments are thoroughly investing in their productivity.
And yet isn't ours also, and its farm subsidies and some of these other things?
Mm-hmm. In some ways, but you know, it's not dependable in the same way that
no,
Toyota knows that their government's going to be there.
Yeah.
With an administration, the farm subsidies can change.
Mm-hmm.
Or with a change in a senator.
And it enters into the area where lots of votes are basically the farmer and the union labor. Boeing doesn't have a lot of votes, per se. Detroit doesn't have a lot of votes. The workers do,
mm-hmm.
but they don't necessarily vote the party line.
Not in the last election.
And you find that our government has tended to knuckle under to the farmer and to labor. Now, don't get me down. I'm wrong. I've got nothing against the farmer. I've got nothing against the working man. But his needs should not be addressed by a government to the exclusion of the rest of our needs.
That's one of the areas I think we as Christians have to address in how we look at the political spectrum. And that's one of the subjects I got into last week. Because how we view that system affecting all of us, not just my own personal interests, says something about the way in which we ought to be governed.
It might be helpful for some people who don't have a background analysis to use some graphs, some elementary supply and demand graphs. So I don't know if everything's clear to people. I guess it would really serve any purpose, but you can show the intersection of supply. It's easy to show the results of different actions, government actions, and pricing. And
I really want to try and stay away from that because, you know, it's something that people spend a lifetime trying to understand and never really quite understand it all. And I try to want to make it as simple as possible, but that is quite possible. They're not unlike insurance graphs.
Could you go over the Federal Reserve and that type money again? Still kind of lost.
It's easy for the administration to accuse the Federal Reserve of making things bad. Because essentially, the Federal Reserve is an autonomous agency. And what they try and do is keep the economy as stable as possible. And that's their mandate. And their mandate does not come from this administration or the last administration. It just comes out of their understanding of the economy of the country. And what they try and do is keep the dollar at an equal level. And maybe this is where he was talking about the graph of supply and demand. If our dollar is to be at a certain level and we want to maintain that, as long as the way in which dollars are used do not cross that line, then it has no problem. But should it not just peak there but then cross the line in terms of consumer goods primarily, then what they do is to take the interest rates and make it a tight money market. They raise the interest rates up on government securities,
That takes the consumer demand for price for particular products and drops it drastically back below that imaginary line. Because if you cannot buy the product, then artificially you have said there is no demand for the product, at least at that price. And as long as the price remains below here, then there's a demand for it. I think one of the easiest ways we saw that in terms of especially the tight money market was the way in which automobile manufacturers came through with rebates, lower interest rates on the purchase of their cars to their own financing corporations to make the prices of their cars somewhat stable in a level so that it was below this level. They took artificially low interest rates for their finance corporations, and they gave you anywhere from, $2 to $1,000 rebate on your car to get it back into the line where you thought it was affordable. Okay? But what happens when you have 18% interest rates and all of a sudden the Federal Reserve Board says, 18's too high, we'll drop it down to 15. Well, their hope is that it will still stable out at this line. Sometimes they've been able to bring it down to 12. I think was the last time it got that low was about a year and a half ago. But then if that gets too high and the demand goes up and the prices are artificially high for that product, then they raise it again and it drops it back down. So what they're trying to do is stabilize the value of the dollar. And they look not just at the way in which we buy in this country, but the way in which dollars are traded on other markets overseas. In other words, other countries receive our dollars in payment for goods and services and or government debts. And then sometimes they sell them back to us. Sometimes they want to hold on to them. And at one point, our dollars were in short supply because they were being hoarded overseas. And one of the biggest places they're being hoarded is in the Middle East, primarily for the sale of oil. Does that kind of help you out?
Yeah. What they're trying to control is the money supply, the amount of money that's in circulation.
And see,
the amount of money that's in circulation is the thing that determines how much the dollar is worth.
Right.
It might be helpful in your discussion of demand to incorporate the term effective demand.
Okay.
There's no real limit on the demand for automobiles.
No.
There's just a limit on what the demand is at the price for which they can be purchased, either with cash or with credit. And the fluctuation interest rate affects that effective demand.
That's precisely correct. Yeah, what happens is the banks give the Federal Reserve dollars when they buy the securities.
Okay, so the higher interest rate, is the higher interest rate the bank has to pay or that they get?
They get.
Both.
So they invest
both.
But see, what they do is, they may be getting 17% from the government, but they're only giving you 15.75%.
Right.
That 2.5 is their profit margin.
They also change the amount that the banks have to hold in reserve. In other words, they may change the reserve rate from 15% to 25%. So the banks have to hold 25% of their money in reserve and can't loan it out. So that pulls a big gob of money out of the circulation.
They can hold the reserve sometimes in the form of certain securities.
Right.
These
right.
Securities draw a lower rate of interest.
Lower rate of interest.
They don't have to have it sitting getting moldy in the vault.
The way the banks are regulated, they have to have money so that if you go in and want all your money out, you can demand it out and get it now. And we've only recently seen where some banks were underfunded. And what happened? The Federal Reserve came in and paid people's accounts off up to the insured rate. And the biggest losers were other banks who invested more than the $100,000 worth of insurance in those banks. For the most part, primary investors, individuals, were not the big losers in the closing of a bank. So other banks are part of that whole process. They invest in other banks.
Is the money supply greater than the amount of paper money actually?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say it's a very small fraction of the supply.
It's represented by some form of paper, though.
All sorts. Yeah, but greenbacks are
Negotiable
securities, stocks,
certificates. the amount of reserve ratio, is that like if I invest $5 in a bank, and the reserve ratio is 5% or something, that means that they can increase the amount of money they have to lend by 95%?
Now, if you have, say, you gave them $5 and the reserve rate is 20%.
So 20%.
They have to hold $1 and they can loan out $4.